Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, supporters of recreational marijuana legalization in New Jersey say they want it legalized because it's a racial justice issue. Just take the new governor, Phil Murphy.
People ask me all the time, hey, are you sure you could generate $300 million from the legalization of marijuana? I said, you know what, I'm not sure. But you know what, that's not the question. We're not doing it for the dollars, we're doing it for social justice.
That was Murphy during the campaign, and we know this argument, right? Blacks are disproportionately arrested for marijuana possession, though blacks and whites use at the same rate. The hope is that legalizing the drug would cut down on arrests. But WNYC reporter Karen Rouse found that one of the major forces of opposition is coming from some black leaders who don't want to see certain aspects of the war on drugs or the heroin epidemic repeat itself if marijuana is legalized. There are also financial aspects to this. Karen Rouse is with us now. You may have heard some of her reporting on this on WNYC over the past couple of days or read her story on it that she wrote for the New York Times. And she's joining us by cell phone in Trenton because the governor is going to be giving his budget address later in the day. And we're actually going to have him on the show tomorrow morning to talk about all of these things. And Karen Rouse will be covering that very important Phil Murphy kind of first major presentation outlining policy specifics that's coming up right after this conversation. Hi, Karen. Thanks for doing this.
Hi, Brian. Thank you.
So, like I said in the introduction, opposition to legalization is coming from what many people would consider an unlikely source, the head of the Legislative Black Caucus, Ron Rice. So tell us about Rice and his argument.
Yeah, so it's sort of this interesting dynamic that's playing out because the argument is supposedly the justification for legalizing marijuana is supposedly to help black people and brown people who have been harmed by prohibition because, like you mentioned, there is this disproportionately high number of arrests for black and brown people. But Rice, he's the senior black senator. He's the longest-serving black senator in Trenton, and he's also a former police officer. And he's saying that this is really something that's going to make white businesses rich, make white people rich, and do it on the backs of black and brown people. He represents Newark, which is the largest city, predominantly African-American city in Jersey, and he's envisioning that you're going to see cannabis shops popping up all over Newark and that whites will come into the city or anybody will come into the city to buy cannabis and that there'll be this new generation of addicts that are created once these businesses pop up. And Newark is a city, like many others in Jersey, that are still struggling with heroin addiction. There is the foreclosure crisis continues in these cities. And he sees this as something that's only going to do harm and that the social justice issue is really just an excuse to justify a business that's not going to benefit these very black people it's claiming to.
So do harm in what way? Is it that people in poor communities are more vulnerable to abusing a drug when it's more readily available, and so there would be harms to the community in that respect? Is that the main argument?
Yeah, that these businesses are not going to go into upper-class communities, and that's sort of what's played out in Denver. You know, the Denver Post and another media organization, Marijuana Business Daily, looked at where the businesses were placed, and they're all clustered in lower-income communities. And so he sees that bringing all the problems with it. So when you talk to the industry, you'll hear all the benefits, the revenue, that it's going to help social justice, but they're not talking about some of the other harms, like, you know, whether it's going to bring in crime, if it's going to create more addiction. And he says that these are problems that he believes will come. I mean, there's, you know, argument over that, but he mm-hmm. believes that's what it will do to his community.
And here's 30 seconds of Senator Rice making his case.
It's always been said that the issue is not money. The issue is social justice. But it's being sold on the backs of black folk and brown people. So now you agree with us. Yes, we do. And we want to get you out of jail. Thank you. Then turn us loose. Well, we can't turn you loose. Why can you not turn us loose? Well, we can turn you loose if you sign this legalization bill. Well, if you said we shouldn't be in jail, I shouldn't have to sign anything.
So there are a few issues packed in there. I think one is the release of people who've been in prison for marijuana-related crimes in the past, yes?
Yeah, and so that's the interesting point he's making, is that everybody agrees. I mean, that's the one thing everybody agrees on in this, on all sides, is that there has been this disproportionate rate of arrests for black people compared to whites when usage rates are similar. So he's saying, if we're all agreeing there's a problem, then why do we need to sign this law in order to set those people free, as he puts it?
Mm-hmm.
And why is this all hinging or hanging on the legalization of marijuana? If it's wrong, then cut those people free. I mean, I don't know that you can just do that, but that's his argument, that this is sort of hanging on that, and that this is really to benefit those businesses, those growers and sellers and transporters, people who want to get in on the industry in New Jersey if it happens here, because it is a billion-dollar industry in the 9 states in D.C. where it's legal.
And there's also a question of who would profit financially from this. Researchers at Marijuana Business Daily, which is an industry news site based in Denver, as you know, Karen, found that 81% of cannabis business owners were white, while less than 4% were black.
Yeah, and even in that 4%, that just means that those were businesses where there was at least one black owner. So it could be, you know, if you and I had a shop, you know, and I'm black, you know, then I count towards that 4%. We count, even if maybe I'm not the primary owner. So it's a very small percentage, and that's something that there are proponents of legalizing marijuana want to see addressed if it becomes law.
And so is there something that Senator Rice, he opposes it in the first place, but any other members of the legislature or advocates outside are saying could be done to kind of guarantee a share of the business, get spread around and even help some of the people as a form of reparations, if that's a fair word, people who've been in prison because of the illegalization of marijuana over time?
Yeah, and reparations is actually the exact word that was used by one of a coalition of black pastors that actually support legalization. And they have a whole list, along with the ACLU, with NAACP, and the Drug Policy Alliance, which is a group here in Trenton. They want to see it legalized, but they want this list of reparations, basically compensation for all the harms from past arrests, like the harm of, you know, little loss of potential earnings, being separated from your family, or not being able to get an apartment because of a record.
Right. And you're breaking up a little on the cell phone. I don't know if you can reposition yourself to help with that. But while you're trying to do that, here's a clip to that point of Reverend Charles Boyer of Bethel AME Church in Woodbury at a marijuana legalization forum held recently at the Bethany Baptist Church in Newark.
The worst thing that could possibly happen to people of color is that marijuana is made legal and none of the past harms that have been done to black people are addressed. Do we want to be the ones responsible for playing a part in a system that will make tons of young white millionaires after years of making hundreds of thousands of poor black felons?
And with WNYC's Karen Rouse at the State House in Trenton waiting for Governor Murphy's budget address as we talk about the social justice pros and cons of one of Murphy's big proposals, recreational marijuana legalization in the state. Karen, how do people like Pastor Boyer want the past harms to black people to be addressed?
OK, Okay, so I think the number one thing is they want to see people who have prior records to have those records expunged immediately. And they also want to see that those people get a chance to be part of the marijuana industry, that they're not denied access because of those prior records. And that's something that's actually happened in other states, where you have people who, in the past, they sold or were caught in possession of marijuana, they ended up with a record, and now it's legal and they cannot participate. So that seems like a real injustice right there, that now people who are in the industry are sort of elevated, and they're sort of like, it's almost like the new tech industry. They become the stars, the new cannabis sellers. But now because you have a record, you cannot participate. So they want to see those people allowed to participate. They want to see revenue from the sales of marijuana put back into the communities that were harmed for education, for job training, business training. They want to see diversity requirements for permits, for access for women and minorities. And they want to see permits priced so that they're accessible, because the permit for operating could be in the thousands. And they see that as an obstacle to many people in lower incomes, from lower incomes, to participate. And there's also this sort of argument about, it's called grow your own. So the idea that if you're a resident in Jersey, you know, you're allowed to have, say, 6 marijuana plants, and you're allowed to grow your own so that you can produce your own crop of marijuana. And there's sort of a fight over that, because the author of the bill in the Senate doesn't like that idea. He visited Denver, and he said that that's just out of control, that people grow too much and that they want to start selling it on their own. But the social justice aspect or argument of that is that if you grow your own, you're not then reliant on those cannabis shops popping up in your neighborhood, and then you can't also be taken advantage of by the industry. You're not reliant on that industry, and you could produce your own.
Pierre in Westerlo, you're on WNYC. Hello, Pierre.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask, I believe that in California, with the legalization of recreational marijuana, they have set up a stipulation that past sufferers of felons that have been locked up have to have something to do with the businesses.
Yeah.
You don't know anything about that?
Yeah, well, we were talking about that as a concept for New Jersey. I guess Pierre is suggesting that they are doing that in California's new legalization regime. Is that right? Do you know?
Well, so I know that in California and other states where it has become legalized, that there is sort of this return, because the social justice aspect is sort of in this state where people are realizing that those who have records are not able to participate. Now, San Francisco did announce that they are, I believe it was San Francisco, did announce that they are releasing people who had arrest records. Now, I don't know about, Pierre is talking about the entire state of California and allowing some sort of set-aside, maybe. I think that California is discussing various types of reparations or compensation for communities of color.
Diana in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add an extra voice to this conversation. So I am the policy counsel with the ACLU of New Jersey, which is a founding member of the statewide coalition, New Jersey United for Marijuana Reform. And in New Jersey, we have really been pushing for making sure that racial justice and social justice stays at the heart of our legalization conversations here in New Jersey, because as Karen Rouse described, other states that have legalized marijuana and then tried to add in racial justice later have found themselves scrambling. And New Jersey has the opportunity to really capture racial justice and social justice on the front end, so that we can make sure that we encourage a diverse pool of applicants for these job opportunities and these licenses that are going to come along. We need to make sure that we don't have just expungements for people's records, but automatic expungements, so that people don't have to go through the hoops and the hassles and pay the tremendous costs to asking for an expungement for behavior we're saying is now legal.
So, Diana, let me ask you, and then Karen, let me ask you, how much receptiveness you're finding in the state legislature for legalization in general and for those social justice writers as you just laid them out, Diana?
So we are finding that as people become educated on this issue, they start to get it. It starts to make sense. They understand that cannabis is not the gateway drug that we were led to believe for decades. They understand why this is a critical racial justice issue. And they understand that in order for this to really be considered a justice bill, we have to capture racial justice in the legislation.
Diana, here's a post from a listener, kind of pushing back on what you just said. This person writes, no ex post facto laws. Felons knew they were breaking the law when they did the crime. Now they want to run pot shops?
So we really need to think about this as not that the laws were in place and they were broken and so people need to continue being punished for them, but these laws should have never existed in the first place. From a public health perspective, there are doctors. There's an organization, amazing organization, called Doctors for Cannabis Regulation that can really explain why cannabis prohibition never made sense from the get-go. And so when we talk about restoring justice and making people whole, it's really disingenuous for us to legalize marijuana and force people to continue bearing the negative stigma of a prior arrest.
Diana, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And WNYC's Karen Rouse, I know you have to go in a minute to hear the governor's budget address. What's your take on the headcount in the legislature at this point? We were talking about Senator Ron Rice, who's against it at this time for the harm that he feels would come to urban communities if marijuana were legally available. I believe Senator Rice has a history of opposing all kinds of so-called harm reduction strategies to fight the impacts of drug abuse. So how many allies does he have in the legislature? Can you tell?
I don't know exact numbers, but just for people who are in this industry and, you know, the talk, it sounds like they don't have the numbers right now. But you know, there are constant meetings with the governor, constant meetings. I mean, Diana, who just spoke, she's a very big advocate. She was featured in my story. You know, I think they're working on it, but I don't think the numbers are there now. And it's really hard to say because it's not a Democrat thing or a Republican thing or a South Jersey or North Jersey thing. It really varies. I mean, you have a couple counties that don't want to see it. Even Murphy's own home county doesn't want marijuana there. So it's just something that I think they're working on. But I think on a whole, I think people believe that it will come because it's in these nine states, and I think people are sort of adjusting to the idea. So they believe if not this year, then maybe next year, they see it as something that's going to come.
Let me correct myself on when the governor is giving his budget address. I gather now that Karen is going to a pre-budget address thing to cover shortly. I apologize. And the budget address itself is 2:00 this afternoon, and listeners, if you're interested, will be streaming it at WNYC.org. Also, Governor Phil Murphy will be a guest live on this show tomorrow morning around 10:30. But if you want to hear the budget address live, that'll be 2:00 this afternoon, and we'll stream it at WNYC.org. Karen, do you expect this issue to come up? Is marijuana legalization, his proposal for it, part of his projected budget?
You know, he talked about it. He talked about the budget a little bit yesterday on another show, and he didn't bring up marijuana legalization. So I haven't heard much from him on this. I don't know if he's just sort of letting the legislature sort of work it out right now. I don't expect that to be part of it, but I might be surprised.
Yeah, and I guess State Senator Nicholas Scutari, a Democrat from Linden, who's white, is the author of a bill that would legalize the possession of small amounts of marijuana for anyone over 21 and would establish a state division of marijuana enforcement. The bill does not include any language discussing compensation. So how much is he being pressured to address that before he tries to move the bill, you know, through committee and to the floor?
I think he's going to face a lot of pressure because And he is a Democrat, and he does agree that there is a social justice problem. He believes that that problem can be resolved simply by legalizing, and then you don't have those people arrested. But you do have people like Diana, who's at the ACLU, this coalition of pastors, the NAACP. You have all these organizations now that are saying social justice is not just legalization. It is at least two parts, and it includes some sort of compensation to those communities that were harmed. The very same communities that were harmed need to be somehow compensated. And I think he said he's willing to consider those things, but he wants to see it in maybe a second bill. And that's something that Rice feels like is sort of like turning the tables on them, on the social justice aspect of it.
We talked about Ron Rice's issues. Where does the rest of the opposition come from?
So it's just sort of traditional opposition. You have some black pastors. You have a group in New Jersey. Diana mentioned a group of doctors who are for it, but there is actually another group called New Jersey RAMP, New Jersey Responsible Approaches to Marijuana Policy, and they include healthcare workers and law enforcement, parents. And they are talking about what they say are harmful effects of marijuana. So you have disputes over whether it's actually physically harmful to people. And they talk about things like traffic fatalities being up in Washington state where it's legal, or usage being up among 12 to 17-year-olds. And then even the social justice angle. So in Denver, it's now legal for adults, but then you're seeing within 2 years of the legalization in Denver, you saw the number of African-American youth who were arrested go up like 58%, because it's still illegal for young people to use marijuana. And then so that racial disparity still shows up.
WNYC New Jersey reporter Karen Rouse. We'll be listening, Karen, for your reports on Governor Murphy's budget address later today. Thanks so much for coming on with us this morning.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are pleased to welcome Governor Phil Murphy for his first appearance on the show since being elected. He was here as a candidate, but for the first time now as governor on this day after unveiling his first proposed state budget, one that he calls a fiscally and morally balanced budget. Governor, thanks so much for making this one of your stops today. I know it's busy. You just came from an NJ Transit board meeting, and you're doing a million things. So welcome back to WNYC, and thank you.
Brian, I'm very happy to be here. I'm looking forward to hearing that Beatles hair salon discussion later.
Yeah, only the important stuff.
Exactly.
And listeners, we will take your calls for the governor. I'll ask him some questions first, then we'll do a call-in section for the rest of the half hour, and we will limit this to New Jersey callers. So if you live in New Jersey and have a question for your new governor about the budget or anything else, 212-433-WNYC. And we definitely want questions from people who've been hearing or reading about these budget proposals with the new taxing and spending priorities. So call us up, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, especially with that. And Governor, you say fiscally and morally responsible, but when I Google the words Murphy budget, I get headlines like NJ.com, here are all the taxes Phil Murphy wants to raise or enact in his first budget. NorthJersey.com, higher minimum wage, higher Uber fees, higher taxes, how Murphy's budget hits New Jersey. They use the word hits. Patch.com, Murphy wants to raise sales tax. So do you need to start taking the narrative back from the media already in some way this morning?
Now, I feel, Brian, first of all, it's good to be back. I feel very good about what we presented, and I just want to put it in context for folks who are listening in, particularly from New Jersey. So we're digging out of an eight-year narrative that was all about gutting government spending. You mentioned I was at NJ Transit's board meeting this morning. I think the first governor ever to do that. They're a poster child for gutting spending. A narrative that said no matter what, taxes have to go down, even if they were gimmicks. And a narrative that ripped our values away from us. So we used to be a state that was never a low-cost state to live in, but it was good value for money. People came here for public education, higher education, infrastructure, our values. It was a fair equation, and we have had 8 years of that equation where the premium to live here has gone up, up, and up. particularly borne by the middle class, not just in taxes, but non-tax taxes, like fares on NJ Transit up 36% as the state government gutted its support. And the basket of things that a middle-class family got back in New Jersey shrunk by the day, whether it's poor service, underfunding public education, higher education, roads not getting repaired, whatever it was. So this, in I think a very responsible way, resets the narrative in this state. You can't do everything in 1 year, but this is about tax equity and fairness, and it's about getting back to the basics of investing in education at all levels, from pre-K up through higher ed, infrastructure, transit, both rail and buses. And the objective is for folks to say, you know what, I'm getting a lot back at last from this state. This is the way it used to be, and that's our objective.
Some Republicans are already calling you Florio II, a reference to the one-term Democratic governor from the 90s who never recovered politically from raising taxes in year one. Yep. Here's Republican Assemblyman John Bramnick, who represents parts of Union, Somerset, and Morris counties.
If the first thing a new governor does is raise the sales tax and other taxes, that's a signal to everyone in New Jersey, hold on, baby, this is just the beginning of the ride.
What's your reaction to just the beginning of the ride and the notion of Florio II?
So I'd say the following. I am not here worrying about my next election. I got elected to do what's right in New Jersey, period, full stop. And that's what we're going to do. And that is, we're going to, at long last, after 8 years in the wilderness, get back to investing in the middle class and making this again a place where folks say, you know what, this is the place you got to be. This is where you want to bring your kids up. This is where the business ought to come to. We're back to getting that momentum that we used to dominate. We used to dominate the innovation and infrastructure economies. We've had leadership that allowed our edge to whittle away. We're going to get that back. So I'm not thinking about politics. I'm thinking about what's right for the next generation and the generation to follow. I would just say to John, who's a good guy and a friend, you know, John agreed with Governor Christie to a complete gimmick to preserve Governor Christie's narrative, to cut the sales tax just when he raised the gas tax so he could say he didn't raise taxes. John knew at the time that it blew a hole in the side of our budget, as everyone else did, just to feed that personal narrative of the former governors. I'm not going to be that governor.
And here's one more clip of a legislator, and this time a Democrat, and obviously the legislature is Democratic Party controlled, so you have the State House and you have the legislature, but here is Assembly Majority Leader Lewis Greenwald.
We shouldn't have any discussion around taxes until we have an opportunity to review the impact on the federal tax reform.
So what's your reaction to waiting to see how that Trump tax hike on many New Jerseyans shakes out until like next April 15th?
Yeah, so again, Lou is a friend, and I think he does extraordinarily good work. We already know how the tax plan from Washington is going to impact New Jersey, and there's precious little of it that's positive. And so this is, you may have noted, if not, I want to make sure the listeners from New Jersey noted, for instance, that's why we're challenging the constitutionality of that tax plan at the highest levels with other states. It's why we're coming up with creative solutions. It's why I raised the cap on deductibility of property taxes yesterday from $10,000 to $15,000, which would include another 540,000 families. The very wealthiest among us, the biggest corporations among us, I think there's broad agreement on this, are going to do really well from the Trump tax plan. So on top of the already important imperative to reclaim fairness in our state, particularly with the middle class first, the Trump tax plan furthers that rationale. And so I'm looking forward. We had a great discussion before the budget yesterday with Lou and colleagues from his side of the aisle. We briefed both sides of the aisle, in fact, before it. I'm looking forward to the next couple of months, and I'm very confident we'll end up in a good place.
So if there was a lukewarm response by the leaders of your own party to the budget, do you see it as a political fight, or is it really over substantive difference among New Jersey Democrats?
I think at the end of the day, and I'm proud of this as a Democrat, I think this will be that we're going to prove to be the party of substance. Again, we've inherited a state that was led by the other side for 8 years, which ravaged the middle class and ripped away our soul as a state. And we are, I'm very confident that fellow Democrats, and by the way, I hope we have help from across the aisle. Some of the concepts we talked about yesterday in our budget, such as raising the property tax limit for deductibility, that has bipartisan support. So I'm confident that we will prove to be not just a party, but a state at the end of the day that makes decisions based on, you know, we call balls and strikes. We make decisions based on fact and substance.
On your appearance before the NJ Transit Board today, a story in The Record says you describe your budget as nearly tripling state investment in NJ Transit, but a closer look at the numbers shows it's less than that because of reductions from other sources like turnpike tolls. So the net increase is actually not triple, but less than double. What's accurate in your view this morning?
I'm going to stay with tripling. If you look at a bar chart, as I have of the past 10 years of the state support for NJ Transit, you had, I think, 3 years in a row, and it was, you could pick them, unfortunately, almost any three, but 3 years in particular in a row where the total for 3 years of the state support was less than a third of what we're putting in our budget for next year. As we sort of think about, Brian, the economic development in our state and reclaiming our rightful place, in almost every conversation I have with CEOs who are either here or coming here, five things come up. Taxes, as they should. We want to make sure we're smart about that. Public education, higher education, infrastructure, particularly commuting, mass transit, trains and buses, and our values. You know, where are you on gun laws? Where are you on women's health, et cetera? Those are the consistent five themes. So the NJ Transit investment is not just per se into NJ Transit. It is a central element of what we see as our economic development and our economic future.
And before we go to calls, let me just ask you about your proposal for recreational marijuana legalization, which I know is for various reasons, but also provides a new revenue stream by taxing the product, so it's in the budget. Our New Jersey correspondent, Karen Rouse, as I think you know, has been reporting on social justice arguments, both pro and con, for recreational legalization. It would stop criminalizing the activities of young people of color that white people don't get criminal records for, but there's concern that the negative effects of more drug abuse from easier access would be felt disproportionately in poor communities of color, and also that the business owners who would make a lot of money from selling legal weed would be disproportionately white. Could you address both of those concerns?
Well, as you rightfully point out, and Karen has done good work on this, the prime reason to support this is social justice. So we have the widest white non-white gap of persons incarcerated in New Jersey in America. And it is not entirely due to low-end drug offenses, but it is overwhelmingly due to that. And so that's principle number one. That's objective number one. As you rightfully point out, if you regulate it and you do it right, you can earn revenues, and I'm happy with that. God knows we can use them, but that's not the prime reason to do this. Separately, our state, particularly over the past 8 years, has a miserable record of minority and women-owned businesses. If you compare New Jersey to New York, it's embarrassing. So one of the things we're committed to generally, not specific to recreational marijuana, is we got to turn that narrative on its head, and we are committed to doing that. But if you're worried about social justice, if you're worried about keeping this business out of the bad guys, if you're worried about kids getting exposed on an ongoing basis, I respect those who want to decriminalize, but the fact of the matter is it doesn't accomplish any of what I've just said. We need to, and by the way, Brian, I'm also happy we're not state number one. We can learn from good and bad elements of other states that have done this, but regulating it, taxing it, protecting our kids, adult use, and that's the important descriptor. I believe with all my heart that is the way to solve this awful social justice reality.
You mentioned the women and minority-owned businesses. My understanding is that the current bill does not include any preferences for business ownership and also does not expunge the criminal records of people with past convictions for what would now become legal. Do you want those things, and can you get them into the bill?
I mean, the bill has just come up, and so we tend not to get into the specifics of a given bill, but conceptually, both of those things are things that we've talked about and conceptually support.
Elizabeth in Maplewood, you're on WNYC with Governor Murphy. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning, Brian, and Governor Murphy, thank you. I'm the president of the South Orange Maplewood School Board.
Hello, so, Elizabeth, how are you?
Hi, and as you know, there's been a lot of excitement in our community for your starting in office and the work that's underway. I'm looking forward, hopefully, to state aid numbers for our district today, and I wanted to ask two questions. One, I don't know if this has been raised with you yet, and I'd like to find out how school districts can engage with you and how to make state aid dollars stretch further by dealing with the incredibly high health care costs that school districts bear compared to other state and county employers. I mean, it's both a twofold problem, both high health care costs statewide for all New Jersey residents and health care consumers. We were among the highest in the country and not necessarily highest in quality, but also the school employees health benefits plan, which was historically the primary vehicle for health insurance for school employees, has had soaring premiums and hasn't been functioning in the same way that the state state plan that covers state, county, and municipal employees. And this is a way that you could, if we could have reform and make it actually work, state aid dollars would go much further and actually reach the classroom. So I wanted to ask if that's being discussed.
Those two things, and I'm going to jump in and get you an answer from the governor. Governor, go ahead.
Yep. So Elizabeth, first of all, good to hear from you. And Maplewood is and South Orange are both two of the great communities in the state, so, and I'm there a lot. We, as you likely saw yesterday, put a major statement financially. You know, folks ought to rightfully ask, hey, by the way, if you're undoing gimmicks, the prior tax gimmicks, and you're asking for tax equity, what am I getting back in return for that? And I think if you're in a community like Maplewood, which is a big commuting town, as you know, Elizabeth, with a very proud, high-performing school district, you're going to get a lot back. The specifics of which we have not gotten into yet, in fairness, but we have said we are committed over the next 4 years to one step after the other and with meaningful amounts of money to fully fund the school funding formula. And the Maplewood South Orange combined district will be, if we get to that, will be a big winner. As it relates to health premiums, you know, you've got this awful reality where costs are going up. And you've got folks who are, you've got a lot of educators, as you know, who are taking home less money than they took home in 2010 when they had reforms jammed down their throats. I think even the hardest reformers didn't anticipate in their wildest imagination that folks 8 years later would be taking home less money. And it's not only, but it's largely due to health care. And so what we've committed to do, and I mentioned this yesterday in our budget address, is we're going to make our pension obligations. We're going to increase the state aid meaningfully to get it increasingly toward fully funding that formula. But we're going to work with communities and with the educators and other public sector unions to find health care savings that give you that 1 + 1 = 3 reality, where the individual does better, but the state and the districts also come out ahead. And that's one way, as you rightfully point out, that we can stretch our dollars.
Richard in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Governor Murphy. Hello, Richard.
Good morning. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Governor Murphy, I'm not sure if you're aware of the tax reevaluation going on in Jersey City.
I am generally aware of it, Richard. Good morning, by the way.
Good morning. Sorry. To those who don't know about it, there's a tax reevaluation. Our current mayor ran on a no reevaluation platform his first term. Now that he's been reelected and doesn't have to worry about it, we've had our tax reevaluation. And for example, my property taxes are going up from $18,000 a year to $32,000 a year. Yep. Other friends of mine who live in the neighborhood, their property taxes are tripling.
And Richard, let me just jump in and ask you if there's something you want the state to do about this as opposed to the government of Jersey City.
I'd like the governor's position on it, and if there is anything the state can do about it. That's
Governor. Richard, listen, property taxes come up in probably every conversation, or whether it's this where folks are calling in. I'm doing a town hall in Paramus tonight. It's top of mind. And again, we're digging out of 8 years where property taxes have gone up. Educational funding has gone down. By the way, 53% of an average property tax bill in New Jersey is for education. And the formula that I talked about with Elizabeth a minute ago has been was underfunded for 8 years by $9 billion. So that's not an abstract number. That goes right to the heart, not only of the quality of our public education, but to people's property tax bills. I can't control what goes on in any given community, but I can tell you this. We want to do everything we can at the state level and at the same time fight back hard against the Trump federal tax plan to deliver whatever relief we can. So whether that's fully funding public education, raising the deductibility from $10,000 to $15,000, we have an idea which we think has got good IRS precedent to convert a property tax payment into a charitable contribution. There's precedent in 33 other states that would preserve deductibility. So those are all, you know, given the weapons that are available to me at the state level and what we can do to push back against the feds, we're going to do everything we can to deliver whatever relief we can.
Jefferson in Lincoln Park. It's not often you get to say Jefferson and Lincoln in the same sentence, but Jefferson, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. First off, I just want to say I listen to your show every day. I love it. And your show is an oasis of information in these transitional times.
Thank you, sir.
Jefferson, good morning.
Good morning, Governor, and thank you for taking my call. I just moved in October from Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, and I am deeply concerned because I'm sure you read the article series Toxic Secrets about the DuPont contamination in our town.
I have.
I am on the board of the Pompton Lakes Residents for Environmental Integrity and a companion group of ours, the Pompton Lakes Community Advisory Group, works to inform the residents about the cleanup efforts and, you know, what they can do in order to participate in that. And we're concerned because I know there was an article in NorthJersey.com saying that you had Catherine McCabe looking into this to report back to you. And we have been trying to get in touch with her many times and have yet to even receive a response or an acknowledgement of that. And we're concerned that our part of the story is not getting told in this. Yep. It took 10 years of us speaking with these reporters and lobbying to get this kind of coverage before that series ran, and thank God that it did, because we are only just now getting this story told, and it's a century old at this point. They've been contaminating our town since the early 1900s.
Yep.
You know, so I hear you talking a lot about taxes. We're paying taxes in that town to live on contaminated land,
yep,
which just now we got a reeval, and the taxes are going to go up. Meanwhile, the borough council is in the paper saying that there's nothing wrong, that it's being cleaned up. The EPA and and DuPont are cooperating, which is, you know, they're sure they're talking with each other, but they don't talk to the residents.
Yep.
And our part of the story is really not being told, yep, and we are
right,
deeply concerned about it.
So, Jefferson, one thing, I will get someone in the DEP to get back to you, and they will get back to you ASAP. I just don't know what the best way is to get a hold of you. I assume the Brian's people have your number. Is that a number you would that be okay to call you on?
We can do that. Jefferson, we're going to take you off the air, and if you are comfortable with it, you'll give your contact information to us, and we'll give it to the governor's office.
So, and Brian, on this one, I've got my colleagues listening. I want to make sure Jefferson gets called today. Secondly, if the folks listening don't know this, this is a really tough situation, and it's one of these things that brings back memories of Love Canal, which is, you know, those are two words that none of us want to hear again. So we've got our DEP, and I promise you, our commissioner, Catherine McCabe, and her whole team are taking this very deadly seriously, trying to also get as much as we can out of the federal EPA. But with the Trump administration and given the persons who are running the EPA in Washington, I don't have a lot of optimism that we're going to get much support or sympathy. So we are trying to get to the bottom of this, and I want to make sure Jefferson knows we take this very, very seriously.
Ann in Clifton, you're on WNYC with Governor Phil Murphy. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi,
good morning, Governor.
And I saw over the weekend a couple were married in the halls of the high school there who had met 30 years ago in that very hall.
Oh, really? Wow. Well, first I want to thank you for introducing your progressive budget. I really applaud your millionaire's tax, which some of the wealthy in New York State are planning to do voluntarily or would like to do voluntarily. There are wealthy, patriotic citizens who realize our economy is unbalanced and trending dangerously towards income inequality. So your millionaire's tax is greatly appreciated by me and many of my friends.
Thank you.
And then
I'd
had a question,
ask for
right?
something.
Go ahead.
Another way to stabilize our state would be to have a more secure election system.
Mm-hmm.
Given yesterday's vote in Pennsylvania, where I think they will probably need to have a recount, this is something we cannot do with the system we have right now, the DRE black box machines. What we need is a voter-marked paper ballot system so that in the case of a very tight election, we can have a recount.
Governor, how much do you agree?
Very much so that our voting rights and voting, we've got really two issues in New Jersey. And by the way, Ann, I appreciate your good words on the agenda. And I want to make sure folks out there realize this is not class warfare. This is, we want all comers to be in New Jersey, stay here and enjoy it. We want to get this sort of, this is tax equity, and that's what this is about. Brian, we're under... So that we have two levels that we're dealing with in New Jersey, and this is common to some other challenges we have given the past 8 years of leadership. Number one, democracy is too narrow, so we don't have any in-person early voting. We have none of the online registration abilities that other states have. Former ex-felons can't vote. My daughter was 17, turning 18 last year. A lot of states let you vote in the primary. If you're going to be 18 by the general, we don't do that. No automatic registration, Department of Motor Vehicles. So one challenge we have is our democracy is far too closed relative to what it should be. We even, under the Christie administration, gave our voter data over to this Kobach commission, this lunatic that Trump had claiming voter fraud. Separately, we've got Russian influence, let there be no doubt about it. We've all read that. I believe it will continue. So we not only have to deal with opening up our democracy, but to make our systems more secure, we have to do both. We must do both, and we will do both.
And we are just about out of time. But before you go, Governor, as you know, we get to break a little bit of news here with you. And it includes a thank you for agreeing to Ask the Governor, a radio call-in show on the three public radio stations that serve New Jersey, which is us, plus WBGO in Newark and WHYY in Philadelphia. This show we are now announcing will be broadcast bi-monthly from the studios of WBGO in Newark, and the host will be WNYC's Nancy Solomon, who's also the managing editor of our New Jersey Public Radio. The first show is scheduled for a week from tomorrow, March 22nd, from 7 to 8 p.m. And like today, you'll be taking calls every show in that series. So, Governor, thank you for participating in that on an ongoing basis. Anything you want to say about it before you go or anything else?
No, listen, I'm thrilled to be doing it. And we've got a really good model. We're going to be rotating month to month from on-air TV to public radio. I love the model. Great to be on with you again, Brian. And I want to make sure everybody out there listening knows that we're out there. We want to make sure we're staying in close touch. We'll be in Paramus tonight at a town hall. And I really am thrilled to be back on with you.
Governor, good luck with everything. And we'll be talking, too. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Governor Phil Murphy. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we will begin this morning with something very out of the ordinary. At this moment, students all over the area, in fact, all over the Eastern time zone, are leaving their school buildings for that 17-minute walkout for school safety and to protest our country's lax gun laws. It's 17 minutes. in honor of the 17 people killed at the high school in Parkland, Florida. So we begin with 17 minutes of live coverage. We have students and some of our reporters standing by to speak live on the air from schools around the region. And we'll open the phones now, too. As you walk out, feel free to call in if any student happens to be listening. The invitation is good for teachers and school administrators, too, and parents of students who are or aren't walking out. Did you go to school to observe this moment and you're listening in your car or something? Or maybe you're home and just letting it happen. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. WNYC's youth and justice correspondent Sarah Gonzalez is going to help us cover this. She's with me in the studio. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Brian.
And let's go right now to New Jersey correspondent Karen Rouse, who is at Hightstown High School. Karen, can you hear me?
I can, Brian. Are you hearing me okay?
I can hear you just fine. So it's 1 minute after 10 o'clock right now. Are students exiting the building?
Yeah, they actually started exiting about 20 minutes to 10. And, I mean, hundreds of kids walked out. I mean, you see them, and I'm at a distance. I'm behind the barricade because it is a closed campus. But hundreds of kids started filing out. You can see them in their hoodies. They're all bundled up because it's very cold and windy out here. And they filed out onto the school track behind the high school, and they just kept circling the track until everybody was there, and they kept walking the track. And right at 10 o'clock, they just read the first name. So the students are sort of gathering at one spot and just remaining silent and standing still. It's kind of a poignant moment. But you see them bundled up and just sort of kind of giving that honor to the people who were killed in Florida.
What are the demographics at Hightstown High School?
It's a very racially diverse school. I mean, black, brown, white kids. You know, this is a very small town. It's in sort of central Jersey. It's the kind of town that has, you know, the water tower, and, you know, it's a very small community here. Yeah, they're very racially diverse. They're out here in a very big open field surrounded by trees. There's snow on the lawn. They just read another name.
And Karen, we're going to check back with you in a few minutes. Right now, we're going to go up to Jay Shaw, reporter for public station WSHU in Connecticut. He's at Harding High School in Bridgeport. Hello, Davis.
Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mixed up our two reporters. It's Jay Shaw from WSHU, but at Herricks High School in Western Nassau County. Jay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
I sure can. Can you set the scene for us at Herricks High School?
Well, the event is set to start at 10:05 a.m., so students are just starting to trickle out. There's a flagpole flying half-mast. There's snow on the ground. Students are bundled up because it's very chilly outside. When I spoke to the student organizers yesterday, they said that they expect most of the 1,500 student body to show up, and that's because the school officials made time in the day's schedule for the event. So no one will be, you know, no one's going to be punished for attending or choosing to attend the event.
Are there any rules for what is to happen during the 17 minutes?
For the 17 minutes, they plan on gathering at first and then singing the national anthem, reading a letter that the school received from a Marjorie Stoneman survivor, and then they're going to take time to say the names of every single victim of the Parkland shooting. And then after all that, they're going to dedicate the remaining time to discuss amongst themselves what to do next when it comes to ending violence in schools.
Jay, thank you. We'll check back with you in a few minutes. Now we'll go to Davis Donovan at Harding High School in Bridgeport. Davis, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. How are you?
Good. And I can hear some students in the background, I think. What's happening?
Quite a few. You know, I just spoke to the principal a few minutes before 10, and he said, we're thinking 60, 70 students. This is well, well more than that. So students have filed out onto the track. They're, I don't know how loud you're hearing right now, but it must be quite loud. Hundreds of students at this school, which has about 1,000 total students. And now they're walking. I'm watching them sort of form a line and coalesce and start walking around the track. A lot of them have signs, love not guns. They're still filing out of the building. It must be close to the majority of the students at the school.
Now, even with those numbers, that would still leave a lot of students who aren't participating. Have you been able to get a sense that there's political division in the student body, or why some are, some many are, many aren't, it sounds like?
So this, I feel like at this school, you know, we're in Bridgeport. It's Connecticut's largest city. This is East Bridgeport. It's a very racially diverse school, really in close to the heart of the city. I get a sense that the political division plays out a lot more in some of Connecticut's smaller towns or suburbs than here. This has a lot of support from the administration. In fact, the mayor of Bridgeport is here, Joe Ganim, who's running for governor.
Davis Donovan, WSHU, public radio reporter at Harding High School in Bridgeport. We'll check back with you a little later on during these 17 minutes. And Sarah Gonzalez in our studio, you've been reporting in advance of this day. Is it your sense that there will be very widespread participation, or that it will vary, as Davis was kind of indicating there, very much between urban and suburban schools, or maybe higher and lower income areas?
Yeah, so I think I've heard from a lot of students who have taken it upon themselves to organize their school's walkout, and they're all doing it a little differently. They're all doing it their own way. And many of the organizers of these walkouts said, you know, if there are people who don't support this, we don't really hear from them. They're kind of a quiet bunch. That said, there are students who don't support the message of these walkouts. I've heard from a parent in Staten Island who said her school is sort of encouraging kids not to participate in it. We know of a school in Sayreville, New Jersey, who has sort of been threatening, I guess, students who participate in the walkout, saying that they would be suspended out of school, which is not in line with their discipline policy for when students cut class. They're supposed to get detention, not out of school suspension.
In fact, it may not be just Sayreville where that's a conflict. Let's take a phone call from Kimberly in Morristown. Kimberly, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning.
Tell us your story.
My daughter is a junior at Morristown High School, and they had organized a walk out of the building and to have some speakers and then go to lunch. Their lunch is at 10:40. And they were told they could only walk out of their classrooms into the hallway, and there would be announcements, and then they had to go back into their classrooms. And any student who walked out of the building would get a 4-day suspension.
Did they say why?
It wasn't related to me. Why? I believe it's safety is there, the umbrella under which they are stating that this is the reason. They want to keep the students safe.
Safe from what, may I ask, as the school walkout itself is supposed to be for safety from gun violence?
I wouldn't know. I know that there has been a huge ramp up in security since the Parkland shooting. There is talk about having metal detectors that the students have to walk through. They have been told that they're not allowed to leave any door in the building except the front door. As a matter of fact, alarms have been posted in every door, and the police presence has been also increased.
Kimberly, let me just ask you very briefly before we go to our next caller, who's a student in the Bronx who is walking out. What was your reaction as a parent? What did you tell your child? You sound distressed about them being not allowed to walk out.
I told her to get suspended.
Really?
Yeah, I told her I'd support her.
Is she doing it?
I don't know. I think that's going to come down to how many other students will do it, too. I don't know that she's quite that much of a lone wolf to do it on her own.
Kimberly, thank you so much for checking. Oh, Sarah Gonzalez, you have a question for Kimberly?
No, so I just wanted to say that I have been hearing from students on social media especially, who are saying, like, if you're going to get suspended over this, wouldn't that be a great college essay to write about? Like, I got suspended over something that I actually care about and feel passionate about. And a lot of parents are saying, if that's the consequence, we support it.
Kimberly, yeah. Good luck to you and your child.
Thank you so much. Take care.
So news department, it seems like we have a story here. It's not just Sayreville High School. It's also Morristown. Now let's go to Esther in the Bronx, who is a junior at, I think, the New Visions Charter School. Esther, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us what you're doing and what's the scene.
Right now, like, we started at 10. We just walked out of our classrooms. And early this morning, my English teacher wrote down the phone number for this and said that we can call and just, you know, talk about how we're feeling. Like, this morning we just wrote letters to our representatives and, like, Congress members and stuff like that, talking about how we feel about a lot of the stuff that's just been going down lately. So our school's, like, pretty supportive of us.
What did you write in your letter? How do you feel?
I feel like, okay, when I'm older, I want to, you know, be an astronomer. And I feel like coming to school, I should be, that should be my main focus. That should be my goal. I shouldn't be coming to school scared that I won't be able to go home. You know, like, and the fact that that's our reality now, where we have a lot more lockdown drills than ever before and sheltering. And, you know, that's just not what school is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a safe environment for us to learn. And it doesn't feel that way anymore now. Like, even like the amount of shootings that have happened since like the last one, it's just, it doesn't feel like just good anymore. And that's something that has to change. And I know that we are the students, and if change is going to happen, it has to come from us, honestly, because no one else is going to do it for us.
Esther, some people say this is more of a suburban issue and a rural issue, and students in the Bronx, like you are more concerned about there not being metal detectors at your schools and not feeling like you're over-policed in the city. Would that be a misreading by the media if they think that about kids in the Bronx?
Oh, absolutely. What? Honestly, my school does have metal detectors. It does. But that doesn't mean that, like, even though, yes, this may certainly be, you know what, this shouldn't even be a problem that has to deal with people in a certain area. Because us as students, if it happens to one place, it's up to all of us to stand together in solidarity. It doesn't matter if it happens in somewhere rural or if it happens here in the city where I live. It's a problem for everyone, and it's a problem that we should be paying attention to regardless of where we live.
Esther, good luck today. Thank you so much for checking in with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And let's go now to Lily Fiegler, a freshman at Wall Township High School in New Jersey. Lily, it's Brian Lehrer at WNYC. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Set the scene for us. What's happening at Wall?
Well, we have our groups of students outside, and we're playing music, and we're all holding hands for unification.
Uh-huh. And are people giving speeches?
No, we're just standing as a moment of silence.
And are you? Do you have the support of your school administration?
Yes, we do. The teachers came outside with us just to make sure that we were safe and that nothing was happening.
What do you hope the message is that you and so many other students around the country are delivering this morning?
The message that I hope that we send is that, you know, we're not just going to sit here and live in fear anymore. This isn't just an adult issue. They don't get some of the stuff that we have to live with and the how terrifying it is to think that we aren't safe and that nobody's safe. So we have to be able to stand up and say, we're not going to take it anymore. You can't make our decisions for us anymore.
Lily, thank you so much for checking in with us. We really appreciate it. Now, with me in the studio is Sarah Gonzalez, our youth and justice reporter. Sarah, it's amazing so far, and we're going to keep taking phone calls. And listeners, if you're just joining us, we're doing 17 minutes of special coverage during the 17-minute walkout in honor of the 17 people who died at the high school in Parkland exactly 1 month ago today. That was February 14th. Today is March 14th, and the 17-minute high school and even some lower grades walkout is supposed to be taking place at exactly 10 a.m. local time. So it's now in the Eastern time zone. It'll be in an hour in the Central, et cetera. And Sarah, we're 14 minutes into it. It's amazing what we've been hearing from these students.
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, the way that this is happening in elementary schools versus middle schools versus high schools is really different. There's a school in Brooklyn, PS8. They sent out an email to parents sort of telling them what the rules are there and reassuring parents that, you know, for the grades K through 3, kindergarten through third grade, they don't speak specifically about gun violence and gun deaths. Because they don't think it's very age appropriate. Once they reach fifth grade, they kind of start having those conversations. And so in the lower grades at that school, there is what they call No Place for Hate Ambassadors. And they're just going to be reading this poem about, you know, being kind to one another and walking out, forming a circle around the school and holding hands. And so it's, you know, it's more age appropriate. I will say there's a school in the Bronx that is, you know, we're hearing a lot of comments about students being safe during this walkout. And that is a concern. The DOE said that they're assigning staff members at every school in New York City to be outside with students just to make sure that there's order. And, you know, and there's a school that's requiring permission slips for students to get back into the school because they say, you know, we want students to have their parents' permission to walk out. And for one student who I spoke to, Leah Yoz, she said, you know, that this kind of feels like a field trip instead of a protest. And she goes to a very high achieving school. And she's concerned that if students have to go home, or if they had to go home, ask their parents for permission to participate in ditching school, that they wouldn't do it, and that this would prevent them from walking out when they want to.
By the way, Kimberly in Morristown, Twitter is really blowing up with your story. So many people in support of you telling your daughter to walk out and get suspended if that's what she believed in. So you can have a lot of support out there, and your daughter is, if she actually does it, even though Morristown High School isn't allowing kids to walk out right now. With us next is Ali Boivab, 15 years old, a student at the Brooklyn Latin School. Thank you so much, Ali, for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you.
Can you set the
scene? We all.
Go ahead. You want to say something? You can go.
I'm just amazed by the sheer magnitude of students that I see here, my fellow peers and my classmates, my teachers who are here to support us and to make sure that and ensure our safety, essentially. But the atmosphere here is very serious. We're all taking a moment of silence. I look at every single of my classmates, and I can see that how sincere we are to this cause, and the fact that we are coming to this realization that the war that's fought in the Congress is getting students slaughtered, and we cannot be doing this anymore. I think that this walkout here, students coming out and showing their side of activism, is a statement to the government, to our officials, to finally take action, because we cannot take this anymore. This could have been us. This could have been our school. It could have been my friend. It could have been my teacher. And when I think about that, my teacher doesn't have to come to school, which is a sanctuary for students to grow and heal. She doesn't have to come here and worry about a shooter. That's not her job, and that's not our job to worry about that.
Ali, beautifully said. And Brooklyn Latin is one of those specialized high schools, as they're called, that students test into in New York City. So a lot of very high-achieving mm-hmm. kids aiming for top colleges. Do you find among your peers that they tend to be in any way less politically active, more focused on themselves, or more in fear of any blemish on their school records than you think might be the case at other schools?
Well, I'm a freshman here, but I did not expect this turnout. But when we organized and spread the word and allowed our student council to speak to the students, we realized that we have a lot of activists here in our school. We are both academically involved, and now I realize that we are also politically involved, and we are involved in terms of improving our world and improving our school, essentially, because this is a threat to us. It's not only a threat to schools that are perhaps in other areas where guns are more easily accessible. But even in New York City, I think we are vulnerable. Every school is vulnerable after the Parkland attack. So it's crucial for us to be outside. And I realized that it wasn't only my realization. It was the realization of my fellow students.
Ali, thank you so much for giving us a few minutes. I'll let you go back to your friends there and participate in what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
And we have on the line now Nuzet Waheed, a senior at the Academy of American Studies in Long Island City. Nuzet, thank you for coming on. Welcome to
WNYC.
Can you hear us, Nuzet? Yes, you are on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Hi.
So, set the scene. Where are you? What's it like?
Hi, Brian. Sorry. Hold on. Hi, Brian. What were you saying?
Oh, I was just asking you where you are exactly and what's going on there.
So we're in the courtyard. We're just finishing up. Well, the students are walking back in. There's a lot of high energy here. We're putting back our posters. We're walking back. I think it went really well.
And it's now 10:20, so I guess kids are starting to go back. Why did you decide to walk out for 17 minutes?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Why did you decide to participate?
Why did I decide to participate?
Uh-huh.
I think there are a variety of reasons, and it's mostly because when I saw the videos of what happened in Parkland, it made it more real, and it made me realize... And it made me realize that there's a lot more at stake than just simple politics. It's our own lives that are at risk. I have a younger brother. He's a freshman in high school. And I don't think I'd ever want this to happen to him, ever.
I'm told that 2 days before the Parkland shooting, a student at your school threatened on social media that he was going to shoot up the school. Were you aware of that?
I'm sorry, Brian, what did you say?
I was told that 2 days before the Parkland shooting, a student at your school threatened on social media to shoot up your school. Did you know about that?
I was not aware of that, no. Okay. I mean, I was not aware of that, but now that you inform me, that's a very scary thought. And I think the people at our school here, we try our best to support each other to make sure that our community is well served, and so that we cater to everyone else. I wasn't aware that one of us.
Right,
had
and it was, and I just want to say that I have that from one source, and it is possible that I have it wrong, Sarah Gonzalez.
Yeah, it's possible that we have that wrong. So let's not put that out there that there was a shooting threat at her school in particular.
Nuzet, tell me one other thing. Do you plan to stay active after the walkout today?
Yes, definitely. I plan to attend Evening of Action. There's another event that's going on Friday afternoon. I plan to attend the March for Our Lives. This is an important cause, and it's important to stay active with it.
Nuzet Waheed, senior at the Academy of American Studies in Long Island City. Thank you so much. Good luck the rest of the day. And we're going to go to Julia, a student at Bloomfield. Oops, we just lost Julia. All right. So instead, we'll go to Joel, who I think is a middle school teacher at the Green Hill School in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Joel, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Brian. I'm here. Thanks for taking our call. If it's okay with you, I'd love to have the students, the eighth graders that organized the event, talk to you for the walkout.
Of course, you could do that. You want to just set the scene for us a little bit? Middle school is different from high school. Are you doing different things?
Yeah, I mean, we're actually a K-8 progressive school, so we're doing different things across the grades. I think in the middle school, the eighth grade had some education in their activism course first, and then brought that into teaching the sixth and seventh grade, and then also went down and taught the fifth grade a bit. And so on all levels, there are different forms of the protest and the walkout. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so. Did you want to put a student or two on? You can do that.
I'd love, yeah. I have two of the organizers here. Let's try it on speakerphone, and then we'll see if you can hear them.
Hello.
Hello, who's this?
My name is Una Montandon.
And I'm Tyler Phillips.
And Una, Tyler, tell us what you're doing today.
All right, well, so today we organized
big middle school 10s incorporating 7s walkout, and we marched around our blocks with chants that we created, and we got to see, like, our middle school and some younger kids come together.
Right.
And we also were given the opportunity to, like, go down and talk about it, and, like, we just organized a really big movement in our school, and that's something that I think we're really proud of.
It was really amazing seeing, I mean, we got these 10-year-olds who may not even have known about the movement before this event, and they were chanting with us, and they had their signs, and it was...
Our science teacher just told us that she overheard two, like, fifth graders talking, and one of them said, I'm really happy we're out here because I feel like we are genuinely making a difference. And I feel like that's everything that
we wanted to hear.
That's the feeling that we wanted to invoke in, like, the younger kids, feeling like they had a voice and that they could make bigger changes.
You said you have signs. What does your sign say, or anybody's sign?
We use a lot of hashtag enough.
We have give people hugs, not guns. We need teachers, not soldiers, and teachers, not sharpshooters.
Right. A lot of, there were a few kids who used the protect lives, not guns.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites was from the fifth grader. She said 18th century laws for 21st century weapons. That's something that I really felt.
Do you, what would you say to some grown-ups out there who might say, hey, you know, high school students, middle school students, you can't understand the issues as well as the experts, so your voices shouldn't matter as much?
What I want to say is, like, I understand how people might think or not experience, but
we know right from wrong.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, we are fighting for our lives, and I feel like that's the biggest thing that people don't understand. We might not, a lot of the people that they're calling experts are funded by the NRA, but that's a big thing. But at the end of the day, we know we want to be alive, and we find different channels and we find different ways to procure that goal of living through school and being safe at school and feeling safe at our school.
We aren't able to vote, which I understand, but still kind of irks me. So we were forced to channel all of these feelings and all of what we know we can do into these events and these walkouts and these marches. And to be able to do that, even if we don't have an actual voice in the legislation.
You're frustrated with not being able to vote. How old are you?
13.
What do you think the voting age should be?
14. I feel like, no, I do... This is something that I told my parents. I feel like this should be a test.
Yeah.
Like, if you're younger and want to be able to vote.
Oh, you get it automatically at 18, but you get a test if you're younger to see if you're sufficiently informed. Well, you two are obviously really read on the news, so thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time. Please thank your teacher, Joel, for us, for calling in and setting you two up. That was awesome. Sarah Gonzalez?
I do want to say there are a lot of the students who we heard from, like Newshat, and others say that part of this walkout is registering students to vote after the walkout and in the days after the walkout leading up to the next march, which is the March for Our Lives, another national march for gun reform on the 24th. And, you know, they point out that there are a lot of high school seniors who are 18 or are turning 18 this year. And what they want to do is they want to be the generation that votes out lawmakers that don't support gun laws that keep students safe. That is what they keep saying to me.
Let's finish up this special coverage by going back briefly to a couple of our reporters who are fanned out around the area, and then Governor Phil Murphy is going to join us for his first appearance since being elected, and he's going to take your calls from around New Jersey. Our New Jersey reporter Karen Rouse is at Hightstown High School. So Karen, is it over now there?
Hey Brian, yeah, it ended about 5 minutes ago. All the kids walked back into the school. There were hundreds of kids here. And there was also a grandmother, actually, who came out just for a few minutes. She was hoping to join the kids. She didn't realize that it was a closed event. But she said she had 6 grandchildren, and they are not here in Hightstown. They're in other districts. But she's like, you know, we have to support these kids. She's like, they spend as much time in school as they do at home.
and that they need to be safe. And so she stood for quite a while in the cold and watched them and just sort of like joined them remotely.
Karen, thank you. And we'll go back one more time to WSHU, Public Radio's Davis Donovan at Harding High School in Bridgeport. Davis, is it over there?
Yeah, hi, Brian. It's wrapped up here. The students headed back inside. They were they're out on the field in the cold and the snow. It's cold out here and muddy, but hundreds of students came out. And it was actually very powerful. One of the student organizers leading the event said, "How many students here have been near a gun?" Almost all of them raised their hands. She said, "How many students have lost someone to gun violence?" I would say more than half raise their hands.
Wow.
We heard from it was a powerful, very sobering moment. We heard from the superintendent of the school system in Bridgeport, said she supported them. Bridgeport is the largest city in Connecticut. Heard from the mayor of Bridgeport, who is, as I mentioned before, is running for governor, also said that he supported them, and they walked with the students both in and out.
Davis, thank you very much for helping us report this story today. WNYC Youth and Justice Correspondent Sarah Gonzalez, thank you very much for setting up so much of this coverage this morning.
Of course.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, thanks to all you amazing students and parents and teachers and everybody who called in for our special coverage, 17 minutes, and we added another 13 minutes because you were all so amazing, of the 17-minute walkout, which started at 10 o'clock in honor of the 17 people who were killed at the high school in Parkland, Florida. This 1 month to the day since that shooting. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.